Chapter 27 Guernica. It is the morning of September 21, 1989. The dogs of Charleston have begun to whimper in collective terror, while the cats of the city are languorous and unconcerned. The windows of the great houses wear plywood eyeglasses as folks gird their homes against a storm still 400 miles away. The air in the city is ominous and strange and illuminated from the outside in. A pretty lady plays the harp in the window of a mansion on East Bay. When she finishes, she rises and curtsies to a gathering of swells that have gathered for a hurricane party. Hugo will crash this party with his terrible dark fist. By tomorrow, the people of South Carolina will know all there is to know about the rules of the storm. The rules are biased and hard. The great storm Hugo acts of its own lethargic, devastating volition. In an emergency meeting at the News and Courier, the journalists receive a briefing from a grim-faced meteorologist who has tracked the storm for days. He refers to Hugo as monstrous, lunatic, and unpredictable. This is the worst news he offers us, and that the combined wisdom of all the weathermen on Earth cannot guarantee what path the storm will take. It depends, he says, on the temperature shifts, fronts moving in the storm's path, the attraction of the Gulf Stream, and a thousand other things that fall outside the precincts of available data. It can still hit Savannah or Wilmington, or it could be swept northward and out to sea. Where do you think it will hit? What's your best guess? A reporter asks. Sir, I think it's going to hit Charleston, he replies. It's coming right at us. Since I live south abroad, my assignment is to cover any damage to that distinguished but vulnerable part of the city. Molly and Fraser have already packed their kids off with Chad to their summer house in Highlands, North Carolina. But both women have decided to ride out the storm at Fraser and Niles' house on Water Street, near the bend in Church Street. The parents of both Chad and Fraser have adamantly refused to abandon their city during its hour of greatest need. Neither of their children can talk them out of the decision. According to the parents, these houses had weathered storms from the Atlantic for centuries, and it was pusillanimous at best to ask them to hightail it to the mountains. Fraser has a furious argument with her parents that leaves them both outraged and helpless, and their daughter in tears. It has become a city of frayed nerves and temperamental exchanges. I am writing a pre-storm column when I receive a phone call from my mother, who is in the middle of one of her patented dithers. Molly has arrived at her house and is insisting that my mother accompany her back to the house on Water Street. She demands to know that I acknowledge her to be of sound mind and body, fully capable of making decisions on her own accord, and that she is not about to abandon her home and garden to a storm named after an overrated and melodramatic French novelist. Echoing conversations that are taking place all over the city, I remind her that she lives next to a saltwater lake. If Hugo strikes the city, he will come in at night, at dead high tide, with a storm surge as high as 12 feet, and that will put her house, her garden, and herself underwater. As her only son, I order her to accompany Molly and promise to meet her at Niles' house later. Advising her softly, I tell her to pack up her most precious possessions and all the food and water she can carry. When she asks if I think she is some beast of burden, I can hear in her voice the early warning signals of a madness that will soon possess the whole city. All the roads and avenues of escape are clogged up with a manic traffic too eager by half to escape. By early afternoon, the wind is up and the river stutters with whitecaps as they merge in fury. Small craft warnings are posted everywhere, but are completely unnecessary. I drive out to where the surfers have clustered on Folly Beach, riding the greatest waves of the century. While eating the last oysters served at Bowen's Island before the owners close shop and head for Columbia, I write down my impression of a routed, battened-down city. The radio and television have reduced our world to a single, malignant name, Hugo. I make my way into a traffic-less downtown at 4 in the afternoon. One thing I can report with certainty. There is no one driving into the city, but a whole army of folks is fleeing it. I cannot imagine a more apocalyptic scenario. Driving down an emptied-out East Bay Street, I notice that the birds have stopped singing and the seagulls have taken cover, that the koi in my garden pond have sunk to the bottom, their gold-flecked backs hunkered down as the air begins to gust and sweat at the same time. I park my car in Mr. Cannon's old garage in the alley behind Trad Street. I give neither the car nor the garage much chance of survival if the storm hits. Inside my house, I drift from room to room, trying to select items that elicit notes of ecstasy or nostalgia. But I discover I love the whole house and everything contained within its comforting walls. This house has represented something precious to me, a solid reminder that life could hurl good luck at you as easily as it could devastation or ruin. I have no rights or claims on this house, yet it has reached out to possess me. It has turned itself into a bright, lush hermitage of spirit. I cannot bear the thought of it being hurt or damaged. I place duct tape over all of its beautiful windows. I lock its sweet doors, and in her time of greatest peril, I abandon her, that love of my life, and walk over to the Whitehead house. I say a prayer for my house and ask the ghost of Harrington Cannon to inhabit it in my absence. I have no children, I whisper to myself as I walk down Church Street, whose palmetto trees are rattling and whose oaks shake with the ancient grief of storms. My life is half gone. How did I get here at this moment? The light is unearthly, surreal, almost an anti-light. The city gives off a scent of resignation from its stones. About a quarter of my neighbors are riding out the hurricane in their homes, and there is a party atmosphere emanating from many of the houses I pass. The music of Vivaldi rides the growing winds out of one house. Emmylou Harris sings about the Queen of the Silver Dollar from another. Television sets blaze in the sonic lights of dens, where Hugo is the only subject under discussion. I have never before seen Charleston hunkered down or fearful, not once in my life. The city must have felt something like this during the Civil War, when the Union Navy was bombarding it relentlessly. I can feel the approach of the storm in every cell in my body, as though my body has transformed itself into some dark gauge of the planet's mischief. A window shatters in a second-story piazza, and I look up to see a middle-aged man, his face tied with a bandana, breaking into an abandoned mansion. He may be the first looter sighted in the city, but he will not be the last. I flag down a police car and give the cops the necessary information, but the two policemen offer no proof that my fingering a burglary in progress is of any particular interest to them. Their radio cackles with directives streaming from headquarters. I hear an ambulance crossing the city in finger paintings of sound. For a brief instant, I wonder where Starla is, and I pray she is far away. Then I shut her out of my mind completely, the one thing I have learned to do best. I turn the latch to the gate on Water Street, then open the door to a maelstrom, in whose creation I had played a part. The wind slams it shut behind me. I enter a formal parlor where the inhabitants of my own endangered ark cluster around a television. The satellite images of Hugo are breathtaking. It looks bigger than the entire state of South Carolina.
"It will never hit Charleston," Worth Rutledge announces to the room at large. I had forgotten that quality of know-it-all certainty in his cultivated voice. "It'll turn north when it hits the Gulf Stream." Worth recently broke his hip while playing golf at the Charleston Country Club and is still clumsy with his wheelchair. His irascibility is innate, but the accident has made it worse. Instinctively, I have always kept away from Chad Worth Rutledge the Ninth, and I do not look forward to spending what could turn out to be a memorable night in close quarters with the blue-blooded jerk.
In the kitchen, Molly is busy preparing supper, while Fraser passes around appetizers to the worried listeners as the Channel 5 news team keeps issuing disconcerting updates. Several wind-blown reporters, with their carefully coiffed locks aflying, shout information about the wind velocity with a nation of whitecaps boiling behind them. It is 7 p.m., and our eyes are turned toward the terrible eye of Hugo as it moves its malignant powers and its prodigious vortex toward Charleston at its own dark leisure.
"Mark my words," Worth repeats. "The Gulf Stream will turn it."
"Darling," his wife says, "could you please hush your mouth? Only God knows if this storm's going to hit us or not."
"Don't be afraid, Mama," Fraser says, leading her mother to a chair and settling her there, as she is trembling with terror.
"I always thought I'd die in one of these," Hess Rutledge says.
"Nonsense. Only sharecroppers and shacks and poor whites and trailers ever die in hurricanes. More people have been killed hunting deer in this state than have been killed by hurricanes."
Worth holds his glass up for a refill, and I walk over to take it from him.
"What's your pleasure?" I ask. "My pleasure is that my daughter make my drink, and not you, Leo. I didn't realize the village gossip had arrived."
"I'll get it, Leo," Fraser says, hurrying to the elaborate wet bar in the corner of the room.
Molly peeks her head out of the kitchen and calls,
"Worth, behave yourself. Fraser and I already talked to you about being nice."
"I should have stayed home," he grouses. "My house is built like a castle of hot pine. It is hard as granite. It would survive a nuclear attack."
"It's beside the harbor," I say.
"The surge could cause waves higher than your house."
"The Rutledge Bennett Mansion has survived 200 years without listening to the advice of a Roman Catholic," Worth replies,
bringing my mother into the fray, a woman well able to defend herself.
"Worth,"
she tells him with great frosty languor,
"I know that Christ died on the cross to save the souls of all men, but I can't believe he'd do it to save a bastard like you."
"Lindsay,"
Hess Rutledge murmurs in a tone of wounded dignity.
"That was unnecessary. Worth lashes out when he's worried or scared."
"Scared?" he scoffs. "Of what? A little rain? I tell you, the damn hurricane will turn. How many times do I have to say it?"
"Tell Leo that you're sorry," Fraser insists.
"Sorry, papist,"
he says, but laughs when he says it, and I know he is trying to make a joke to save face. The gesture is insincere, but I accept it in the spirit of a night's distorted reality. Niles joins us after finishing the job of X-ing all the windows with duct tape. Then Fraser says,
"Trevor, will you play the piano? The most beautiful music you know. Nerves are on edge here."
"Is AIDS an airborne disease?"
Worth asks his wife, not bothering to lower his voice. While Trevor plays, Molly serves us plates of oxtail soup, pork and steamed asparagus, boiled potatoes, and salads. We form a line and pass things hand over hand until everything is on the table. As we sit down to dinner, Fraser asks me to say grace, and we all take one another's hands around the mahogany dining room table that had once belonged to Mrs. Rutledge's great-grandmother. Trevor halts his rendition of Mozart in the middle of a piano concerto, but isn't ready to join us at the table. Four candelabra ignite the charged air with pearly, comforting light as I pray.
O God of wind, O God of storm, we place ourselves in your hands on this night of mystery, this night of fear. There is a reason you brought this group of people together, and that is a mystery we will understand at daybreak. We ask that you be kind to this city and this home and these people. Because of our worship of you, we understand the calamities that can befall the world, the nature of whirlwinds, the power of words, and the glory of the Last Supper. We trust in your mercy, and tonight we hope you will justify that trust. I'm sorry Worth Rutledge doesn't like Roman Catholics, and I trust you will torture him in everlasting hellfire for that grievous sin. Amen."
"Amen," the others say, and even Worth utters a stiff laugh.
I hate showy, over-elaborate prayers, my mother comments pointedly as she picks up her spoon.
We need one tonight, Dr. King, Molly says as she prepares a plate for her father-in-law. Leo, roll Trevor to the table.
I'm not hungry, dear heart, Trevor tells her. Just let me waste away over here while I tickle the ivories and trip the light fantastic.
The music comforts me, Mrs. Rutledge tells him with a wan smile. I feel like Noah's wife before the flood.
It's a hurricane, her husband says. Rain and wind, it's not a flood.
How are the children? I ask Molly.
Safe in Highlands. Chad says every inn is packed, as is everything else there. If things get bad, we may have to go to your place, darling, she tells Niles.
And to the rest of us, Ike's parents are already there, and so are the kids.
If I went north, I'd stay at Grove Park Inn, Worth says, concentrating on his meal. A plush luxury hotel in Asheville. Know what I call camping now? A Ritz-Carlton.
My mother clears her throat and throws her napkin to the table.
I cannot spend a hurricane with this vulgar man.
Be quiet, Mother, I command.
We'll always have Paris, Dr. King, Trevor says, and begins to play As Time Goes By from Casablanca. He knows my mother reveres it. He finishes with a flourish, and in the moment of silence, Molly murmurs, My God, listen to that wind.
We should have stayed home, Worth Rutledge repeats. If we die here, we won't even be dying in an important house.
Shut up, Worth, his wife answers, standing up suddenly and heading for the guest room in the back of the house. She is followed quickly by Fraser, who spends 10 minutes calming her down. When Trevor finally tires at the piano, I carry him to the couch and tell him I won't rest till he drinks a milkshake, at least, before he falls asleep. The one great illogical result of AIDS is that Trevor keeps losing weight, no matter how many calories I manage to stuff down his gullet. He constantly accuses me of overloading him, like a French farm wife in the Dordogne, force-feeding a goose. I try 100 sneaky ways to get him to eat the most fattening foods I can conjure from a lifetime of cooking, but the food is not nourishing him. I bring the milkshake to Trevor, then stand over my mother, who can't break away from the television, with its lifeline of information and advice. Hugo now looks like a gun sight with its crosshairs trained on our city. I pull on a rain slicker to go outside and take a look, and tell my protesting mother, I'm covering the hurricane for the paper, and South Abroad is my beat. I've got to see what the water looks like, I insist. I'll come with you, Molly says. You most certainly will not, Fraser tells her. Think about your children. Okay, she says as she pulls on her slicker. I thought about them. Let's go, Toad, before it blows any harder.
It takes our combined strength to force the front door of the beleaguered house open, then it slams shut with a fierce bang when the wind gains control of it. Debbie Chard just reported wind gusts up to 80 miles per hour as Molly and I make our wind-blinded sprint to the battery wall. A strange emerald light unnerves us both as we hold hands and struggle to stay upright while we run toward the hurricane. Climbing the steps leading to the seawall, we both grip the steel bars where tourists usually look out toward Fort Sumter and admire the mansions of East Bay. The rain stings my eyes and a sudden wave, crashing over the seawall, comes close to washing us into the street behind us.
I get the idea, Molly shouts over the wind.
We straighten ourselves up and watch Charleston Harbor turn insane and deadly. The water frightens me. I thought I had seen it in every shade of green and brown and gray. But now I watch the Cooper River leap out of the channel in a pure, undone white. Hand in hand, we make our way back to the house with the wind behind us, making us feel like world-class sprinters. We are laughing hysterically as we are met by Niles at the front gate.
Go to the back door, kids, he shouts. Front won't open. Went out to lock the shed, and a crepe myrtle flew by my head, scared the shit out of me.
You risked your life for a tool shed? Molly says, the idea tickling her.
Name a more embarrassing death, I shout as we round the corner of the house. There is none,
Molly says. Our laughter continues as we go inside, shaking off the rain and describing the harbor. It is extinguished in an instant when an explosion erupts nearby, somewhere on the street. The flame of a burning transformer flares the sky briefly, and the house is plunged into total darkness. We make our way inside by feel to the living room, where Trevor calls,
It's as dark as God's pocket in here. Storm lanterns?
Molly asks Fraser, who is feeling on the sideboard for matches.
Light the candelabra, she tells her, and get out the flashlights.
She speaks in a slightly raised voice, as Hugo has begun roaring into the city with its demonic winds, snapping pine trees as though they are chopsticks, sending them hurling through the illuminated darkness, crashing through the windows. A water oak is blown over next door, and more electric transformers explode like bombs up and down the street. Niles and I peel back a corner of a storm shutter to stare out of a small corner of a window on the leeward side of the house, amazed by the shine of the turquoise green light that allows us to watch cars and yachts fly by, airborne and seemingly weightless. A dachshund flies by the window screaming. More transformers blow in the next block, and wires come down, coiled like spaghetti. A stop sign razors into the trunk of a palmetto. Giant gusts of wind almost lift the house from its foundation, but the old house holds firm, like a barnacle against a rock. When Molly finds us by the window, she screams,
Are you nuts? If the magnolia falls, it'll take off your heads.
Good point, I say. Niles and I retreat to the living room. Our ears begin popping and our mouths are dry as the air pressure plummets. Soon we are gasping for breath as we pass around iced-down bottles of water and beer.
The house is holding,
Niles offers in a cautious optimism that my mother quickly squashes.
Beware of unwarranted optimism, my mother warns.
God damn it, Lindsay, Worth snaps. You always talk like an English teacher.
Not true, Worth, she answers acidly. Sometimes I'm seized by idiocy. Then I talk like a Broad Street lawyer.
Worth can't answer, as the extraordinary noise of the hurricane is rising, the house shaking so hard the light from the candelabra shakes.
We shouldn't have stayed, Molly calls over the roar. The house is giving.
This house is 200 years old, Worth shouts back. Our ancestors built these houses to last. They'll withstand any disaster.
Your ancestors didn't build anything, Mother says. Their slaves did.
Worth is readying himself for a rejoinder when Mother's voice rises another notch.
Water! She cries. My God, Leo, it's the surge!
As we'd sat there, water had begun to leak into the house from every doorway and window. At first it was slow-moving and methodical. Then the wind ripped the plywood off the windows, and glass began popping all over the first floor as the pressure of a high tide and a 13-foot surge of ocean water leaned against the house with the full force of its unbearable weight. I was ankle-deep in water before I moved a single muscle.
Can rain do this?
Fraser shouts, her face incredulous.
It's the ocean paying us a visit,
Niles shouts back in reply.
I always wondered why they called this Water Street. Let's move it.
I get my mother to her feet and direct her toward the stairs, while Fraser picks up all 80 pounds of Trevor and meets me at the bottom of the stairs, where the water is swiftly rising. I shout at her,
Can the best basketball player in the history of Ashley Hall get my friend up these stairs? You're goddamn right I can,
she shouts back.
Can you get my parents up?
You're goddamn right I can. Niles, you got Mrs. Rutledge?
Coming out with her,
Niles calls, all darkness and hallucination as he passes with her in his arms. I fight my way through the water to get to Worth Rutledge in his wheelchair.
Where are you, Mr. Rutledge?
I shout at the room.
Here, Leo,
he answers in a quavering, hopeless voice. When I reach him, groping through the rising, turbulent water, I find him up to his neck in seawater and completely unhinged. He grabs me and, in his desperation, pulls my head under the black, unquelled surge. I lift both of us into the air and shout in his ear,
Worth, I'm going to float us over to the stairs. Don't fight me. We've got to keep our heads above the water.
I hear Niles splash into the water behind me. Then two lines of light from two flashlights catch our heads as I struggle to keep both my head and Worth's in the air. I realize that there are actual waves, wind and tide driven, rolling through the antique-strewn drawing room. Niles reaches me, and it is his strength, not mine, that gets us to the stairway. Worth screams in agony as we lift him into the stairway, his broken hip almost broken a second time, and get him to the landing. There we put his arms on both of our shoulders and carry him up to his grandson's bedroom. He is delirious with pain, groaning loudly when Mrs. Rutledge comes into the room, her unpinned hair streaming down her face. By flashlight, she searches through her soggy handbag and finds a vial of pain medicine.
"Mrs. Rutledge," I say in admiration, "in all this mess, you remember to save your handbag?"
"A lady never goes anywhere without her lipstick," she raises her voice to answer.
She taps out a few pills and tells her husband,
"Eat them, Worth. There's no water."
He promptly obeys. The second story appears to be holding, and we towel off and clean up as best as we can. Niles and I sit on top of the stairs with flashlights and candelabra and monitor the rising water in case we have to make an emergency evacuation to the attic. A depletion of body and soul overwhelms me as Niles and I sit there in astonishment, watching the water rising stair by stair. Around 3, we notice that the water has stopped its radical ascent. It stands still for half an hour, 2 stairs away from the second story. Then, visibly, it begins to recede. Outside, the winds have slowed as Hugo begins to muscle his way out of town. The candles are nearly extinguished in the candelabra when Niles says,
"It's over."
He surprises me by reaching over and grabbing my hand. In the eerie darkness and beauty of returning water, he simply takes my hand. I think it is just something he needs to do. As we sit there watching the water recede, I think about Niles in the orphanage on the day I met him, and guess he had wanted someone, anyone, to hold his hand during the long, dreadful forced march of his childhood. It was the least I could do, as he had long ago taught me a lesson about the great inner strength sometimes granted to the most wounded of men, and how those men can sometimes grow up to be heroes. We fall asleep on the top of that stairway, and when I wake just after dawn, it is to a stillness that is more than still, a calmness that is more than calm. I go to a window and look over the stricken city. Roofs have been blown completely off, piazzas felled, trees decapitated and uprooted. My city looks firebombed and unsalvageable, as if Hugo had taken it with a perverse sense of artistry and turned Charleston into Guernica. Niles wakes not long after me, and we descend the mud-blackened stairs. The ruin of the first floor is complete and unimaginable. Every piece of furniture, every antique, every oriental rug, 2 chandeliers, portraits of the Rutledge ancestors, every spode plate, all of it violated or gone. A foot of mud covers everything. The food that was in the refrigerator and freezer is scattered, hidden by the ubiquitous mud, already beginning to rot. For the next few days, the city will reek like a cesspool. I make my way to the window where Niles and I had watched the storm. It is now open, the double pane shattered. A 1968 yellow Volkswagen convertible sits in the middle of Niles's front yard, crumpled like a tuna fish can. Beside it lies the bloated corpse of a golden Labrador retriever. Fish are everywhere. The smells of sewage pervade the unrecognizable, un-Charleston city. Niles joins me there and puts a hand on my shoulder.
"Go ahead and cry."
I cry, but it grants me no release from the sorrow I feel. The city of the rarest man-made delicacy is on its knees, all putrefaction and carrion. We can't stay here, Niall says. Let's see if your house did better than mine. We pick our way with great caution across the yard. God damn, he says, as we gingerly step over a downed, wrought-iron fence. The shed held better than the house. Indeed, the padlocked shed looks sturdier than the house, the watermarks almost to the roof. Worth's ancestors built that, I comment dryly, making Niles utter a bark of laughter. We climb over what is left of the fence and slowly make our way up Church Street on the east side of the street. It looks blighted and firebombed, but we reach the spot where the surge ceased its incursion, the mud line. Dead birds are everywhere, a dead cat, a yield sign torn in two equal parts, an Exxon sign blown in from God knows where, a smashed car, a downed live oak, an entire piazza in a yard. Ruined gardens, ruined gardens, ruined gardens. To add insult to injury, the day has dawned hot and beautiful. The heat of the relentless South Carolina sun speeding up the awful odor of corruption. Turning the corner of Trad Street, we encounter even more destruction. This is not the place where I have lived my entire adult life. We shuffle with extreme caution through a street full of broken glass until Niall stops me when we arrive at my house. It looks good, Niles offers cautiously. Where's my garden gate? Gone with the wind, Niles answers dryly. Do you have a key? I hand him a key, and he unlocks the front door. We enter. Everything looks the same. My house stood firm against Hugo. The roof lost some tiles, the attic sustained water damage, and there were windows broken here and there. But my home had endured the worst of the storm and come through it as well as any house in the city. I cry, and again it brings no relief. Take off your clothes, Toad, Niles says. Why? Because they're filthy, he says, retrieving some towels and a couple of bars of soap from the bathroom and running shoes from the closet. Glass, he says, as he puts on a pair and heads for the rear garden toward the bird bath that overflows with new water. He splashes himself down from head to foot, then lathers up with soap. I do the same, my hair as stiff as an osprey's nest, then silken as the sun warms my desolate garden. Walking to the koi pond as I towel off, I mourn their death, then watch a small miracle as three survivors make their way to the top and flash the golden password of their miraculous survival. I have to go to work, I say. Of course you do, Niles says, but I wouldn't go like that. Looking down at my nakedness, his nakedness, we both laugh until we become giddy, sounding more like the noise you would hear coming from an asylum than from a Charleston garden. After I dress, I make my way down a forlorn, wrecked-in King Street in a daze, walking over broken glass while avoiding the tangles of downed wires as though they are pit vipers. I climb over and through the branches of fallen trees. A policeman stops me and tells me I could be shot as a looter. I roar with laughter for a second time that morning, then show him a very soggy press card. "You're Leo King, the columnist," he says. "Fancy that. I'm Sergeant Townsend." "Could you do me a favor?" I ask. "No, I couldn't," he says. "I'm on duty. You may not have heard, we had a storm last night." I explain that I'm a close friend of Ike Jefferson and need to get a message to the chief. I tell him Niles needs help transporting some folks from his home up to some cabins in the mountains. "Why should Chief give a shit?" Sergeant Townsend asks. "He's up to his ass in alligators." "His parents and his kids are already up there," I say. "Ike didn't order you to arrest looters, did he?" "Nah, the jail is packed. Said to beat the shit out of them instead." "That's my guy," I say. "Your name will be in the paper tomorrow, Sergeant." Ike sends a station wagon to Niles' house, and we load everyone in, except Molly and me. Niles does not like the thought of leaving Molly behind and argues that she can't do anything for anybody until the National Guard clears the debris and power is restored. He points out that the damage to the Rutledge home and her own home is so devastating that she can't even begin to repair it without a construction team. But Molly remains adamant about staying, and she surprises me by saying, "Leo and I are going to find out what happened to my grandmother's house on the beach." Niles says, "They're not letting anyone onto Sullivan's Island. The National Guard is keeping everyone off. The bridges are impassable." "I found a boat," Molly says. "A bateau with a motor. It's ready to go." "What will I tell Chad?" Fraser asks. "And your kids?" "Tell them I'm in Brazil," Molly answers dryly. When they finally leave, Molly and I walk to the remains of the marina. We stop by my mother's house and find it wrecked and sad. The Poe home nearly collapsed. But Molly is set on her mission and has no time for reminiscence or emotion. Ike has found her a boat, and it is tied to a remnant of the devastated marina. Boats and yachts are strewn across Lockwood Boulevard in cruel studies of wreckage. The sleekness of a million-dollar yacht is turned to mockery as it lies smashed and disfigured on a Charleston roadway. But Molly is single-minded and unreachable as we inch our way through a slain nation of boats to get to a small bateau that survived Hugo and Ike's neighbor's garage. I start the engine and Molly points a finger out toward Sullivan's Island. I tell her I know the way, and if I get my ass shot by a National Guardsman, our friendship is off. She does not laugh or say a single word as we cross Charleston Harbor and witness the devastation of the city as we pass by the great houses on the Battery. Because the boat is small and the tide is running high, it takes more than an hour to reach the southern edge of the island. Two shrimp boats are marooned in the middle of the salt marsh. Then we begin passing beach houses, or what used to be beach houses. "The poor Murphy's gone. The poor Ravenel's gone. Claire Smith will be sick over this. But good for the Sanders and the Holtz. They're still standing. The poor St. John's and the poor Sinclairs," Molly murmurs. The litany of names continues as we make our way toward her grandmother's beloved house. Wheezy's house. The summer house. Coming soon. Coming soon. "Where is it, Leo? Where's Wheezy's house? Why would God take Wheezy's house? It's gone. It's all gone." Molly bursts into tears as I turn the boat toward the gap-toothed space that Wheezy's house once occupied. I pull the boat up in the sand and secure it as Molly faces the negligible ruins of her childhood. She is on her knees in the sand, weeping, screaming, and out of control. Not much giving a damn who witnesses or hears her grief. Only a pathetic remnant of the house is left, a half wall beneath the house, and a cement floor where we once played ping pong and danced to the music of the Seaburg jukebox. The jukebox is gone, and the ping pong table demolished. There's a cheap naugahyde couch that miraculously survived the deluge, but the water has moved it to the one remaining fragment of a far broken wall. There's a floor lamp, a dryer bag, and a 45 record, the sole survivor of the missing Seaburg. I pick up the record and read the label. Johnny Cash, Ballad of a Teenage Queen. My God, I think. That song told Sheba's story long before she got here. I hear a man's voice yell, "Halt!" Looking up, I see two painfully young National Guardsmen with their rifles locked and loaded and aimed at us. I drop the record on the cement floor and raise my hands in the air. Molly rounds on them.
"Get off my fucking property," she screams. "You've got no right to be in Wheezy's house. Get out of my grandmother's house and never come back unless I invite your asses, which I never will."
She trips in the sand and sinks to her knees. One of the guardsmen shouts, "We've got our orders, ma'am. No one can come on the island. We're trying to prevent looting."
"Looting?" Molly shouts. "You think I'm here to loot? What would I fucking loot? Hey, there's a ping pong ball. Let me loot that. A beer can. Do I see an old license plate over there? Do you know what I really wanted, young man?
No, ma'am,
both guardsmen answer, lowering their rifles.
The photograph albums. Pictures of my family coming here every summer. 5 generations of us. Priceless photographs. Lost. Gone forever.
Gentlemen, I call. I'll take care of the lady. I'll get her off the island. Give us a few minutes.
That'll be fine, sir, one of the men says.
Then they leave. Molly, the Charleston aristocrat, had intimidated the boys from the upcountry. When I last look, they are running for their jeep. It is lost on Molly, who has begun wailing again. I let her wail because there are some emotions beyond comforting. The privilege of sharing such an intimate moment with Molly is not lost on me. We are standing on sacred ground, a monument from her childhood. Though the house can be rebuilt, it will take another 50 years for it to be sacred ground again. Molly stops weeping only when we both hear an unearthly breathing somewhere near us. We walk wearily to the waterlogged couch that is facing away from us and find a 6-foot porpoise lying on the cushions as if placed there by the hand of God. It is miraculously still alive, and without breaking stride, Molly orders me to find something that will enable us to carry the porpoise down to the sea. I find a fragment of the splintered ping-pong table that looks large enough for the job. With extreme care, we load the porpoise onto the slab of wood. We labor and grunt and sweat as we bear the porpoise to the waves. We look like foot soldiers bringing a fallen comrade off a battlefield. The porpoise is heavy, dead weight, and Molly and I are still weak from the same ordeal that almost killed the porpoise. I fall to my knees, then rise in time for Molly to fall to hers. But we keep the porpoise steady and move him toward the high tides the moon is bringing to Charleston. As the sun is setting, we reach the water and walk out till we are waist deep. Cradling the porpoise, we let the fragment of table go. We continue to walk the porpoise through the sun-shot harbor as Molly's complexion turns to gold in the fresh, dazzled waters. For 15 minutes in our exhaustion and the peril of our brother mammal, we walk that damaged porpoise going with the tide. We splash it with seawater and exhort it to live. Finally, demand it. We both need a sign that Hugo could not take everything from us, that a spirit lived in this land and in these waters that no hurricane could touch. Eventually, the porpoise's breathing grows stronger, and it starts to move beneath our hands. Its skin becomes shiny. It looks like a gold slipper in the last light of the sun. When I think I can go no farther, when I believe I will drop into the ocean and die myself, the porpoise suddenly knocks me over with a kick from its powerful tail and leaves us forever, with Molly and me shouting, tears streaming down our faces. We fall apart at the seams again. But that is all right. Our friendship is a bright ring between us. On Monday morning, I write about the trip to Sullivan's Island and Molly's terrible story of finding her grandmother's house completely destroyed. But these stories are told 1,000 times this awful season in Charleston. It is the porpoise that gets to my readers. By saving the porpoise, Molly has saved something in the soul of Charleston. I describe Molly Huggy Rutledge's beauty, and I confess that I have loved her since the day I first saw her. Though I didn't intend it to be, the column is a love letter to Molly. In the final paragraph, I admit that I looked at her in a new way when that porpoise ignited to life and kicked away from us. This was a woman I had never known before. This Molly Rutledge had turned herself before my eyes into a sea nymph, a goddess of the storm. Chapter 28. 7%. On the Friday after Hugo, Molly and I drive to the North Carolina mountains to retrieve our storm-tossed families. Molly has succeeded in having three separate work crews begin the cleaning and repairing of the damage at the Rutledge's mansion, her own house on East Bay Street, as well as Fraser and Niles' house on Water Street, where we had unwisely chosen to ride out the worst storm in the history of Charleston. I have managed to find a construction team from Orangeburg to start cleaning out the foot of black mud in the house where I grew up. I feel as though someone has put me through the rinse cycle of a washing machine for an entire week. Molly has spent the last 7 days on her hands and knees cleaning the ubiquitous mud and scattered debris from her house. She and Chad owned some of the most valuable antiques in Charleston when the waters leaped the Battery Wall. I discovered that Water Street had once been a creek bordered on both sides by salt marsh and a favorite place for Charlestonians to fish and shrimp in the early 18th century. Though the city filled it in and killed the marshes, the river preserved a memory of superb integrity and chose an ancient, dishonored path in its headlong charge into the city. You can bury all the streams and creeks you want to, but salt waterways remember where they came from. Molly falls asleep as soon as we turn onto I-26 and does not awake until I make the sharp upward turn on the road that leads to the four shotgun houses where Starla and Niles were born. For years, I have heard that Niles was restoring these cabins of his childhood, but I was not prepared for the excellence of the carpentry and the shrewd attention to detail. He and Fraser have restored these ramshackle, unsafe shells into houses pretty enough to sit in the French countryside. On strong, fortified stilts, the four houses still hang over a pretty trout stream, and that clear water rushing over rocks becomes our white noise and our sleeping partner for the rest of the weekend. Chad has brought his and Molly's two children, as well as Niles and Fraser's kids, on his way from Highlands to Chicago. They rush out to greet Molly. The Jefferson kids pile out of their house. They all charge me at once and almost knock me down in their headlong joy and cries of, "Uncle Leo!" Mother walks out of the fourth cabin, and the sight of her moves something deep inside me. She looks like an old woman for the first time in her life. We embrace and hold each other and refuse to let each other go, and in that clinch of blood and family, we share a rare moment of connection as we listen to the stream rushing below us. "My magnolia trees?" she asks. "Standing tall," I say. "The house?" "The first floor flooded, ruined. Got a bunch of guys cleaning it up. You can live with Trevor and me till we get it cleaned up." "Your house?" "A few scratches," she answers. "Then God does answer some prayers. Very few in Charleston lately." Trevor is sitting on a screened porch playing a harmonica, of all things. But Trevor could play Rachmaninoff, tapping a butter knife on a drain spout. The harmonica seems congruent with these rough mountains and their swift coursing streams, and he sounds like he's been playing the instrument his whole life. He is playing Barbara Allen when I enter the house behind him, and I wait until he finishes. I give him a glass of white wine and lean down to kiss his forehead. "A little light making out before dinner?" I ask. "You've always been such a tease," he complains. "All talk and no semen." "Forgive me for unleashing that beast," I say, looking back at Mother in the doorway. "Beast? I find that a brazen come-on," Trevor says. "How do you know how to play a harmonica?" I ask. "I once heard you say a harmonica is to a piano as a sardine is to a sperm whale." "Oh, a sperm whale," Trevor says. "By far my favorite kind." "You and Mother getting along?" "She's been a peach, Leo. A living doll." "Hugo changed her," he says. Then, with a nod at the harmonica, "Let me explain the instrument to you, Leo. You control the sound by covering these holes with your tongue. I'm an artist with my tongue, if you really want to know." "I'm sorry I asked." "But wasn't the answer fun?" he says. "I've always loved the suggestion of filth. The mere hint of the obscene with a small drop of malice has always been my favorite form of humor."
"I smell charcoal burning," I say. "Niles is ready to cook. Where's Chad?"
In Chicago, on business. You think he was going to babysit his kids for a whole weekend when there's money to be made? Then, abruptly, I dream about Sheba every night, Leo.
I can't talk about Sheba yet, I warn him. I'll be able to soon, but not now. We haven't had a chance to mourn her yet. But we've got the rest of our lives to do that. I may write a book about Sheba. About all of us. About this.
It won't sell a copy if I'm not the main character, Trevor says. We are laughing when we hear the dinner bell ring. Our first meal in the mountains is celebratory, even sacramental. Niles cooks steaks for everyone, and Fraser makes enough salad and baked potatoes and fresh vegetables to feed a changing of the guards. Coach Jefferson plays bartender and keeps the glasses filled all night. Mrs. Jefferson tries to coax any news we might have about Ike and Betty, but the only information I have received is that they are working around the clock and both have performed heroically during and after the assault of Hugo. Molly tells of her walks through the city and the sheer massiveness of the destruction. She has made the amazing discovery that a palmetto is more likely to survive a hurricane than a 100-year-old oak tree. Her theory is that the palmetto tree has more natural flexibility and can bend all the way to the ground and still survive, but an oak knows only how to stand firm against the amazing blasts of wind and makes itself susceptible to the perils of uprooting. She reports that the Citadel campus has lost more than 50 oak trees, and she believes that there is not a single flower left blooming in the city. I say that the News and Courier has reported only 32 people killed in South Carolina, a number that seems incredibly low to me after what we endured on Water Street. Modern communication has enabled people on the coast to remove themselves from danger, and most citizens heeded those warnings. A few dumbos, like us, waited it out in our homes and paid a stiff price for our hubris.
Leo, I know you're talking about me, Worth Rutledge says. I plead guilty as charged. I demanded that my wife stay, and, of course, that meant that Niles and Fraser and Molly had to stay behind to care for us. If anyone had died, I'd never be able to forgive myself.
We all made it, Worth, Mother says, and had that rarest of all things in life. We had an adventure.
I hope it's my last, Mrs. Rutledge says.
We were happy to miss it, Coach Jefferson says,
and his wife laughs in agreement.
It's like those football practices in August. Remember the two-a-days, Leo?
Never forget them.
Hell, looking back, I can't believe what I put you kids through. But I also can't believe I went through it myself.
Mother says, that football season led to a lot of things.
On your first day at Peninsula High, I say, could you ever imagine spending a night like this? The guests of Niles Whitehead and the Rutledge family of South Carolina?
That was a good team, he says, ignoring my question. Good leadership.
Especially the white co-captain, I say. That kid was hell.
Was my daddy on that team?
Little Ike pipes up to ask his grandfather.
Your daddy and Uncle Niles were the stars of that team, Coach Jefferson says. And Uncle Chad surprised me more than any player I ever coached.
What about Uncle Leo? One of the kids asks.
He would get knocked over on every play, the coach says. But a lot of great linebackers would trip over his body as he was lying there on the ground.
He pauses at my noise of outrage, then admits,
No, son, truth is, Leo didn't have much talent, but he got after it. By God, he would get after it.
Let's talk about the cheerleading squad that season, Trevor inserts with a spark of his old passion. Talk about groundbreakers. I was the first male cheerleader at Peninsula and had the best legs on that team by far.
I beg your pardon, Molly says.
Our group moves inside as the chill night air takes control of the mountain. Niles lights an oak fire with fluid, expert movements, the glow of the fire sweet to the flesh. The house is packed as tightly as a bus, the kids littering the floor or sitting in the laps of the seated adults. Little Ike sits on one of my knees and little Niles on the other. I know I will sleep deeply that night.
I am beginning to get drowsy with the fire when Molly and Chad's delectable 14-year-old, Sarah, speaks up.
Mama, we want to hear about the porpoise.
How do you know about the porpoise? Molly asks.
Daddy called and read it to us, her son Worth Jr. answers. From up in Chicago, he adds, with a childlike wonder.
Molly looks perplexed, and I explain. It went out on the wire.
Leo referred to you as a sea goddess, my dear, Mrs. Rutledge tells her in her earnest formality, with a small note of fondness toward me, unheard of before the storm.
Leo was overriding as usual, Molly says, though her eyes are shining with pleasure. I disagree. I was underriding, I assure her. The children insist on hearing the story from her own lips, and I sit there by the fire and listen as Molly's clear, drawling voice takes us back to the roofless, storm-damaged city we left behind. Her account is straightforward and accurate, but when she comes to the part about the porpoise, the story pulls up lame. She hurries to finish, her voice drifting toward ennui, even disinterest. She ends with the flattest note imaginable, saying,
"We carried the porpoise to the water and let it go."
There's a beat of silence when she is done. Then young Sarah offers with the brashness of extreme youth,
"It sounded better when Uncle Leo told it."
"Molly lacks my son's ability to exaggerate," Mother says in Molly's defense. "What she lacks," I correct, "is truthfulness." I ask the children, "Have any of your parents' dull, witless, and boring friends ever told you any stories?" "No, of course not. The only man in this room who ever told you fabulous, wonderful stories is your old Uncle Toad, the greatest guy of all time, right?"
"Right," they agree, but then instantly begin amending themselves. "Except for my daddy."
The bright, happy children of my friends have offered a secret source of pleasure for me over the years. My childlessness is an inner wound and a point of unrelenting tension between Mother and me. So I turned this lovely troop of children into willing substitutes. I made up bedtime stories for them that I refined over the years. I wanted to dazzle their imaginations, and I never told a story in which they themselves did not have leading roles. I cast them as kings and queens and knights of the Round Table, as green berets and French foreign legionnaires. Together, we rout the nighttime terrors by fighting beasts and giants and bad-tempered dragons. The children and I take on crooks and scoundrels and highwaymen and any bullies they encounter on the schoolyard, or any teacher who brings misery instead of learning into their lives. Though we always fight fair, our enemies always die. That is one of my rules of storytelling. The bad guy always has to get it, and his death is slow and hard. When they go to sleep, the evil lost in a frontier of night lies vanquished and still in the dust as I say, "The end," and kiss them good night. "Let me tell the real story of finding the porpoise," I say. "It'll be your bedtime story for the night."
"I'm too old for a bedtime story," Sarah says.
"You're never too old for a bedtime story," I tell her. "The story's too important for that." "Your father read my column in a Chicago newspaper," I say as example, "and the reason it made it so far was that the story was good."
"I'd accept that in a court of law," Worth says.
Fraser asks, "How many people in this room think Uncle Leo will exaggerate this story?" The entire room full of doubters and scoundrels and humorless literalists raises its hands in the air, and the children's laughter skitters through the room like hurled marbles. I say, "Betrayed by my own mother, the parents of my best friends, the children of my best friends, and then my best friends themselves. It's a low point in my life. Does anything I tell you sound true?"
"No,"
the children squeal in unison.
27% is true, young Sarah offers from her place next to her mother. "Some of it's true." Then you start adding things.
19%, little Ike offers to the floor. "Uncle Leo's had me killing dragons since I was born, and I've never even seen one."
Amid the squeaking of the kids, I am moved by little Ike. "When the lights went out and you were a little kid, alone in the bed, did you ever feel that there were things loose in your bedroom?"
Yes, I still do, says Niles Jr. But after I had told a story, what happened to all those awful things that made kids afraid to go to sleep? Dead, the kids say. 27% dead, I ask. 19%? 100%, the older kids say. Let me tell the story of Molly and the Porpoise. Listen carefully, kids, so you can tell me where I made things up. Then you've got to be able to tell me what is real, what I didn't invent, I say. Kids, I'm teaching you to tell a story. It's the most important lesson you'll ever learn. Standing in front of the fire, I speak a single word. River Run. The first word of James Joyce's novel, Finnegan's Wake. I wink at Mother, who greets my joke with a scowl. As the river runs beneath us, I dive deeply into the sweet water fathoms of story itself. When news of the death of the great actress Sheba Poe flashed around the world, the first person to weep was God. He had taken great care in the shaping of that exquisite woman and thought that Sheba was one of his most flawless creations. As he wept, one of his tears fell into the Atlantic near Africa, and a wind began to move. It was an angry wind, and it asked God what it wanted, and God said, "Gird yourself for battle, wind. Grow strong and fearful. I will hollow out an eye for you in the center of your brute majesty. Go to Charleston. They let my Sheba be killed there. I name thee Hugo." So Hugo rose out of those waters and twisted himself into bizarre and funneling shapes, and he began his fearful trek to Charleston, holding a single tear from God's eye. When he reached Charleston, he crushed the city. His weapons were the winds and rains and tides of God. He chopped down houses and blew away roofs and flooded streets. The only place that Hugo did not touch was the grave of Sheba Poe, which was as dry as a prayer book. Every flower ripped from the gardens of Charleston fell from the skies to honor her, sent to her grave by the hand of a loving and merciful God. This merciful God spared the lives of some people who waited out the storm on Water Street. He let them live for reasons all his own, and we will never begin to understand them. One of them was the lovely Molly Rutledge, who was born a princess in the holy city, and who grew up to become one of its queens. Her childhood was a cakewalk and a dream, and she had most loved her summers spent at her grandmother's house on Sullivan's Island. Queens often feel things that normal people are not allowed to feel. Molly feared for her grandmother's house, for Wheezy's house. She went out to her stable and grabbed a peasant boy named Leo, who worked in the stable taking care of jackasses and chickens. She grabbed Leo by the ear and demanded he find a boat and take her to the island. Leo ran to commandeer a boat stolen by an evil police captain. As the crisp air rushed through the queen's golden hair, she looked back at her hurt city with tears in her eyes. Then she smelled something foul and thought to herself that the peasant boy smelled exactly like a jackass. At the same time, Leo thought this queen smelled like tea olive or jasmine. As they neared the island, something stirred in the water. Molly found her boat surrounded by a magnificent but troubled school of porpoises. When she asked the porpoises what was the matter, a solemn voice called out that the pod had lost their queen during the storm. The queen was stranded on dry land, but they could hear her crying out. Molly made a solemn vow to help. When a queen makes a pledge, it carries the rule of law. The boat rode the waves into the place where Wheezy's house had once been. Molly wept when she saw that the storm had taken Wheezy's house, but she called to the peasant boy, Leo. They ran together and found the stranded porpoise lying on a white couch in the ruins of a flooded, imploded house. The porpoise's name was Sheba, and she looked lost and forlorn and abandoned. She had given up all hope of rescue and had resigned herself to a slow death in the fog now lifting off the waters.
but another queen and a peasant boy who smelled like a jackass placed her on a piece of wood, and they struggled and grunted as they staggered beneath the weight of that lovely mammal. They tripped on sand dunes, and their muscles spasmed in agony as they made it finally to the waves. The school of porpoises was watching the effort and began applauding. They danced across the waters with their tails. In a language that was not interpretable, a language known only to animals and very small children, they commanded that Molly and Leo remain strong and save the pretty monarch. In the ocean, Queen Sheba stirred to life. Then her king appeared beside her, and her honor guard rushed around her in the ecstasy of her survival. Molly cleaned the sand from her blowhole. Arching her beautiful tail, Sheba dove out into the great ocean, which was both her palace and her home. Queen Molly took Leo home and left him with the jackasses and the chickens. She went to her castle. She thought that the loss of Wheezy's house was more than made up for by the recovery of the porpoise Sheba. Always choose life over possessions. Always, Queen Molly said, as she climbed into her bed for the night. Good night, Hugo, and farewell. As soon as I bowed my conclusion, Sarah announced with conviction,
12%.
What about the goddess of the storm part? Fraser asked. That was my favorite part. I've already written that, I say. What's important is that a story changes every time you say it out loud. When you put it on paper, it can never change. But the more times you tell it, the more changes will occur. A story is a living thing. It moves and shifts. If I had each one of you tell me the story the same way I just told it, no one could do it. Now, is it time to get you rascals to bed?
No,
the kids chorus. Past time, Fraser says. When I go to bed on the couch, I find myself agitated and sleepless. I pour a glass of Grand Marnier and quietly tiptoe past the bedroom where Mother and Trevor sleep. The moon is out, and it proves a bright comfort as I walk the road higher up the mountain until I find a shelf of exposed granite I can sit on to think about the rest of my life. I'm thinking about the awful way Sheba died when a penny hits the rock beside me and bounces into the mountain laurel forest below.
For your thoughts, Molly says, sitting beside me and hooking her arm through mine.
She takes the snifter and drinks a sip. Her breath grows orangey and sweet, like it was the night in San Francisco when she came to my bed.
Sheba, I say.
I wonder if she really wanted to marry me or was just joking around.
She thought her career was finished, Leo, Molly says. She wasn't a big fan of Hollywood men. She wanted a kid. She wanted to settle down.
Sheba settling down? I don't believe it for a second.
Me neither. She had a restless spirit, a tormented soul, and a dreadful end.
You don't know how dreadful.
Speaking of endings, Molly says after a moment, thanks for your story. I guess I can quit worrying about how to tell you. You let me know you already understood.
The queen always goes back to the castle, I say. I always knew you'd never leave Chad. And if it helps anything, I think it's the right thing to do.
Please don't go noble on me, Toad, she says. I can't stand that. But I belong with Chad. I belong with my house and children. I belong where I was born to be.
She isn't telling me anything I didn't already know, and I just nod. We sit there another moment in silence. Then I bring our brief glimmer of forever to an end with, predictably, a joke. If Chad ever beats you up or farts too loudly or just wakes up with bad breath and body odor, you can always come to me, Molly. She smiles, but her smile is sad.
If I leave, then your story won't be true. And your story is true, she says. 100% true. Molly kisses me, then walks back down the hill, crowned by moonlight. Now, a goddess of these hills.